Ladies and gentlemen, let's start. Let's start with something pretty simple. Let's give you a test. I want to pull this back just a shade so people on the edge here can see. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to interpret my behavior. I'm sitting down. I strongly recommend if you're off in the corners to head this way because I'm going to be doing some things that require nuance. I don't want to make you crazy. What I want to do is put some thoughts into your head so that you can find, when you need them, they will be available to you. I'm in Ann Arbor, Michigan. The year is 1988. Betty and Jim come into my office. They're a married couple. We're going to start right there. You work with these people. So what happens when they're not in sync? What I'm going to do is I'm going to share with you what happened to me. I got more information from Betty and Jim than I really cared for, but they taught me a substantial amount about nonverbal communication. Betty and Jim come into my office. We're doing a thing called implosive therapy. You have never been in marriage therapy. Let me tell you how it works. You go into marriage therapy, without a doubt, the first question is, how did you two meet? And here's how it works. If you can agree comfortably how you met, and you both agree as to the manner in which you met and how your relationship started, you've got a pretty good chance of being successful. If you start a fight as to how you met, this man is about to become rich. Okay? That's marriage therapy in a nutshell. At the University of Michigan, we're doing implosive therapy. So what we're going to do is sit down. I'm not going to say, how did you two meet? I'm going to sit down with a married couple coming in for marriage therapy, look them right in the eyes and say, do you love your wife? Do you love your husband? Now, I don't care what they say. I'm reading the body language. Benny and Jim come into my office. They obviously are having some marital difficulties. They sit down. Benny sits to Jim's right. I'm going to be Jim on this one. He sits down. He's looking at me. And I gave him that key question. I said, Jim, and if you can't see me in the back, feel free to stand or reposition. I said, Jim, do you love your wife? This is his response. Yeah. All right, now let's take a moment for analysis. How many of you men are married? Show of hands. That's the luckiest. Someone asks you, gentlemen, in front of your wife, do you love your wife? She gives you how much lag time to work out the correct answer? Nanosecond. I like that. Actually indicates fear. You can answer too quickly. And if the nanosecond is your response and you think that's the right response, this is what you're witnessing. Do you love your wife? Yes, I do. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just not right for me. We're looking at a time phenomenon called response latency. And what we know when we do the research is that when you ask a question, you measure the time between the end of the question and the beginning of the response, you can have some degree of confidence as to how much that person is engaged with the answer. Now, let's analyze Jim. I said, Jim, do you love your wife? The first thing he does is check. Which one did I bring? He turns to look at her, and then he does what every woman so thoroughly appreciates, and we discussed it yesterday afternoon. He looks her up and down. He's already killed himself. You go over 2 seconds, it's pretty much done. He then looks back at me, and I don't know if you caught the audible exhale. He looked at her again, sighed, and then said with no emotion in his voice, yeah. I will share with you Betty's response. While he was looking at her, I could see her temperature rising. When he said, yeah, she simultaneously said, I guess we answered that question. Problem with Jim. Response latency took far too long to answer. Realize what's happening. You say to a prospect, are you comfortable with the financial plan we've created for you? Is this policy the one that you think meets your needs? The distance between the question, termination of the question, commencement of the response is crucial. You don't want too quick an answer. Now, if they're all excited and they're just humming and yeah, rubbing their hands, fine, let them yell real quickly. That's who they are. They have an endocrine problem, okay? If, however, they're a normal, average individual, you're looking for 7/10 of a second to a full second. That would be your optimal response. Bill, do you love your wife? Why, yes. I, too, am trained. Housebroken, in fact. So what we're looking at is response latency. Jim messed up because he took far too long to respond, really gave it way too much consideration. Even though he said the right thing, he didn't say it with any feeling or emotion. He was cooked. It gets worse. I then ask Betty.
I said, Betty, and I'm not going to, the one thing I can't imitate in her is that her knees were pasted together. So ignore that part. From the waist down, it's irrelevant. What's going to happen, and I'm going to have to do this twice, the great majority of you will miss what I'm trying to get across. I said, Betty, do you love Jim? And this is her response. She looked right at me and said, of course I do. Now, let me do that one without speech. I don't want to confuse you, but we have a variety of channels going on here. One is verbal. You took years to learn how to write, to learn vocabulary, to learn grammar, to learn how to read, so we tend to value what we put effort into. However, it's the least accurate channel of communication for the most part. I'm much more interested in her body language, so I'm now going to respond using the same body language. I will not speak. I said, Betty, do you love Jim? And this is her response. Okay? Head only. This would mean what in your community? No. Very good. Hands out to the side. Hands out to the side, palms up. It's not a big deal, but I'm stunned because I will speak to hundreds of people who do not know the meaning of this gesture. It is universal, true in every language and every culture in the world. Hands out to the side, palms up, I don't know, is what the arms are saying. Here's a woman who's showing a variety of behavior. She's saying, of course I do. Does that mean yes? How do you women feel when you ask your spouse or your significant other, do you love me? And they say, what are you, stupid? What kind of question is that? Or the classic, what do you think? I know what I think. I'm asking you. What we're going to look at here is the quality of response. I'm looking at the measure of time when I look at Jim. The quality of response is going to be measured by time as well. The time factor here is duration. When I ask a question of someone, I'm looking for the shortest, most direct possible route to a response. Yes or no is the optimal response. Betty, do you love Jim? I'm looking for yes. She does not say yes. She gives me a nautical term that means we're still on course. Of course. Of course I do. Simultaneously saying no with her head, and I do not know with her hands. When I get a variety of signals that are mixed or incongruent, I invariably move to the one that has the lowest level of awareness. It's always the most accurate. We tend to know what we're doing with our heads. We tend to know what it is we're saying. We don't know what we're doing so much with our arms. And certainly not with our feet. Now, she did something else while answering me, which I found rather telling. Number one buying sign by a female. When a woman is compelled in her response, compelled to speak, she will shorten the distance between her lower body and you. So when I see a woman scooching up to the edge of the seat, I almost invariably say, talk to me. What do you think? Here is Betty saying, of course I do, and moving up to the edge of the seat. Substantial number of different messages going on at the same time. Here's how it works. When we look at body language, please realize there are literally no exceptions to what I'm about to say. Body language, nonverbal communication is always more emotionally accurate than what you say. It is always more emotionally accurate and more emotionally revealing or telling. So I'm getting information from these two people. Jim did what with his emotions? Okay? Any of you see USA Today? Did you catch the business section this morning? Go get it. If I could have enlarged it, I would have put it on the screen. They showed two CEOs, one for Continental Airlines and one for United, standing side by side. You know which one's eating up the other. The body language is incredible. One's showing authority and his hands are out like this, and the other one's got his hands folded and he's looking down like he's already been, you know, taken out of business, which is fascinating to me. I look for those behaviors. I look at the pictures. I'll get more from the picture than I do from the text. Okay? And you can too. Just need to raise your awareness level. Gentlemen, let's have a little fun. I'm going to give you some data now. You are free to go home and share this with your wife. I guarantee she'll think you're brain dead if you do what I'm about to say. Everybody in this room, male and female, although females tend to get more credit than the males do, each of us possess three distinct, complete, unique brain systems within our body. Your brain is a complete brain. It has all of the cortex, neocortex, et cetera, tissue. All of the neurological tissue located in your brain is what we call a brain. It's located in two other areas of your body. I want to tell you where they are. Your heart has a full, total, and complete brain, neurological brain, and it's in direct proportion to the brain tissue that you have. The only thing it can't do is speak or consciously think. So your heart has its own brain. Now, we know that because we can do things that will cause stimulation in your heart that won't register in your consciousness. Have you ever had that experience? I did, sixth grade. Mrs. McBreen. Loved her to death. I had a crush on my sixth grade teacher, and she must have liked me because she also was my eighth grade teacher. She had never taught the eighth grade before in a year without me, and she switched and started teaching the eighth grade. I was convinced I knew why. But when Mrs. McBreen walked into the room and she was at least 55 years old, which, as you can imagine, for a sixth grader is ancient, what happened was my heart would pump, 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 pump like crazy. I could hear it. Okay? I didn't sit there going, I love this woman, but my heart did. Your heart, the brain in your heart, responds to passion. All right? Scream out an answer. I'm going to ask you a question. Yell out your answer. What's the opposite of love?
Hate.
Think again. Apathy. Who said it? Okay. The opposite of love is indifference or apathy. All right? Think about it. Hate isn't the opposite of love. Hate and love are opposite sides of the same coin. My belief is that they're both passions. And guess what? The heart and the neurological system responds the same to love as it does to hate. Hate might have a little more intensity to it. But what we find that's kind of interesting is the heart will send you signals, information it may pick up and respond physiologically before your brain catches up to what's going on. Okay? Kind of a funny thing, I'm at a zoo in West Virginia with my kids, and there was a bear. It was a rainy day, and we were probably the only people there. And they had a big glass wall, and we were looking in the glass wall, and the bear looked me right in the eyes and ran on all fours and just went bam against that glass window. Okay? I knew in my head, there's no way this bear is getting through this plexiglass window, but my body went crazy with response. That's what's going to happen. The third brain that you have in your body is located in your abdominal wall. Okay? I'm going to be candid with you. It is in your colon. Okay, and so what we're going to find is you have all of the neurological tissue in your brain located in equal proportion, much smaller tissue, but equal proportion in the walls of your colon. We have a thing called irritable bowel syndrome. We have spastic colon. We used to think that psychosomatic illness was kind of psycho. Well, it's actually very accurate. And what happens is the brain tissue in that part of your body responds to threat and danger. Response to threat and danger. I remember I had to inform one of my students that one of her parents had been killed in an automobile accident. Her immediate response was to vomit. That was not a surprise to me. Okay? Threat, danger, I'm expecting some abdominal response. And you've probably had the same situation. In fact, we have a phrase for it. You say, I had a gut feeling about this. You know what? You actually did. So what we learn in studying nonverbal communication is that it is not unfair to trust what's going on in your subconscious. You generally have very good hunches, especially females, because they tend to be more willing to entertain that notion. Males, we get rewarded for logic. When we look at left and right brain, left brain being logical, right brain being emotional, what we have historically seen is that young boys are punished for being emotional, unless it's anger. And they even get punished for that. But they don't get rewarded for showing warmth, for showing consideration. And we do now. We're changing. But as a culture, if a little boy cried in the 1950s, you know what he was told. Suck it up, little man. Okay? What we found was he was rewarded for logic. And we're going to look at left brain. About 80, 82% of your activity in your brain, gentlemen, occurs in the left hemisphere. Language, logic, mathematics, and analysis. Right hemisphere is where you think of the hobby. Think of what you do. I'm going to give you 2 hours to do anything in the world you want. You can go to a movie. You can read a book. You can do whatever. I almost guarantee every one of you will go to a right brain function. Color, rhythm, spatial, time and space, okay, which would be body language or sports. We're going to be looking at emotion, color, rhythm, synthesis. You know what synthesis is? I work with variable annuity companies. I work with mutual fund companies quite a bit. Now, I have a different fix. All right, my kids range from 19 down to 4. My 4-year-old was in a diaper about a year ago. To me, I look at a mutual fund like this. A mutual fund is like a diaper, okay? A mutual fund is like a diaper, and it is. There are two types, load and no load. It's that basic, okay? Now, there's back-end load. That's the most common. There is front-end load. It's just water. You can do this. There is level load. There's a skill. And there's the one that every registered rep desires and every parent fears. Load with a trailer. You just experience synthesis. It's fun, isn't it? I combined a diaper and a mutual fund. Y'all sitting there thinking, wow, what's he going to say next? We've got you covered? But what happens is when you combine things in new and unique ways, you can have a whole lot of fun with it. That is a right brain phenomenon. Okay? And so what we see happening is work tends to be left brain or logical, right tends to be where you reward yourself and experience recreation, where you recreate in the most literal sense. Today I want to talk about the three things you must project to initiate and maintain a long-running professional relationship. If you're note-taking, bravo for you. I invariably give you a little green handout, which is a relatively compressed version of what I'll talk about. My plan is to give you about 4 to 5 times more data than I can possibly put into a one-page handout. So let's go there. We're looking at trustworthiness. We're going to have a little fun. Let's divide the women from the men. Ladies, you don't even have to move intellectually. You know you're already out there. What we're going to do is start to acknowledge the difference between females and males. First thing we do, I want to get a feel. So let's get a feel. I'm sitting, I'm listening to you. You're giving me a presentation about a prime product that you represent. And I'm sitting at the table or at my desk and my chin is in my hand. Here's my question for you. It's all about body language, baby. Good listening behavior or not? I need your impression. I'm sitting, I'm listening to you. Is this hand-to-chin behavior a positive listening behavior? Show of hands. Positive, raise your hand. If you think it's a good behavior, negative, raise your hand. Wow. Neutral. Anybody? A couple folks? Let's go over the data. It is a very good listening behavior. I mean, even Rodin had the foresight to put his statue, The Thinker, with his chin in his hand. Big Ten libraries, law, engineering, and medicine. We will find 71% of graduate students reading for depth and understanding touch the mandible while reading. All right? What does that do? University of Michigan, neurological laboratories. We wire these people up. We put them in a soundproof, lightproof room. And a tongue depressor on the mandible will activate the oligodendroglia, the smallest connecting neuron tissue in the brain. Translation, chin stimulation, damn good listening behavior. All right? I interviewed 100 women last year in the field of financial services. 58 out of 100 see it negatively. So what's going on here? Why do so many people see it negatively? And I would argue at least 70% of you saw it as a negative behavior. Hand-to-chin behavior is not a negative behavior, or is it? It's now negative. What have I done differently? I'm chin-propping, ladies and gentlemen. Let's put it to you this way. You're presenting a life insurance product to me, and I feel obliged to hold my head in an upright position to listen. Help me out. How are you coming across? Not too good, are you? All right, here's what's happening. That's the number two most negative behavior, which is associated with the chin. We're going to find if a person is chin propping, they're probably not as entertained. And this is the polite chin prop, where I do it unobtrusively with my thumb and cover it. This is the absolutely impolite one. So you're getting some data. That would be a negative behavior. It is not the primary reason that my 58 ladies saw this behavior negatively. Watch closely. I'm listening to you present at some point during a conversation. Finger moves up over the lip. Different message, one finger. How about two? How about the more transparent 10? If you don't know what a behavior means, polarize the experience. Carry it to an odd extreme, okay? Nobody's going to do this. However, subconsciously, in fact, they are. If that hand, for any reason, is covering the lip while you're speaking, such as you're now doing to me, 80% accuracy, that behavior alone. Cynicism. Translation, I do not believe what you're saying. All right? Do you realize what's going to happen? You're going home to a spouse in several hours. You're going to say, hey, would you help me do X, Y, Z over the weekend? You see your spouse going, yeah, I guess I will. You now know what they really feel. That is a self-editing behavior. Let me go in great depth on the behavior. If you weren't here yesterday, we made a discovery. And it is that men think one thought at a time. Right? And as I confirm for you ladies, it's almost always the same thought. Gentlemen, you know that women think 4 to 6 thoughts on average. One researcher in New Zealand has identified as many as 13 simultaneous brainwave patterns in a female. 13 successful thought patterns going on at the same time. So you're listening, they're interpreting all kinds of data. All right? Hand to chin behavior. We're going to look at it from a listener perspective and then from a speaker perspective. As a listener, hand to chin behavior is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, I don't have a problem with it at all. When it's chin propping, it's a different behavior. You have to make that distinction. When that hand covers the lips, you get a very different life experience. Should that finger... Now realize, I can even go out to here. Have you ever had somebody sit and listen to you like this? They are assessing you personally, and they don't like you. This is a negative personal assessment behavior. If they sit like this before you even begin, they may not like the situation in which they find themselves, but it tends to be a negative behavior. All right, so finger into the cheek, what I look for is the amount of tension. Is that finger like grinding through the cheek, or is it just hanging there? I'm not too worried about it. I might ask a question, get the hand away from the face, because that's what I prefer, but you don't have to go crazy with that stuff. Hand to chin behavior. At any point during a conversation, if I'm moving into this region, it says, I do not believe what you're saying. Cynicism. Now, where is he? I've got a gentleman with a goatee over here. I've got another one here. I've got a beard over here and another goatee. If you have facial hair, gentlemen, you are 2 times more likely to touch your face while listening. If there's any silver or gray in it, congratulations, that behavior will be associated with wisdom. That's good. There is a dark side, however. You're also 2 times more likely to touch your face while speaking. And you can tell me what impression you have when I just touch my chin as a speaker. I will give you our answer. Lack of confidence. If you touch your face while speaking, the positive thing you're doing is called lack of confidence. It gets worse. All right? Now, gentlemen, if you have a beard or goatee, 2 times more likely to touch your face while listening, 2 times more likely to touch your face while speaking. Women with facial hair, we saw no statistical difference. Try to cover both sides of the street. Doesn't that make sense? What are you going to do? All right, let's take a look at this. It is a Friday, and on Saturday morning, it turns out that in Salt Lake City, that is the one day in your community where they will pick up, the trash man will pick up a refrigerator, a stove, heavy appliances. They only do it once a year, and it's tomorrow. So you come up to me, and I say, you know what? The wife and kids are gone for the weekend. I'm going to watch movies late at night Friday. I'm going to drink myself into a stupor if that's what I'm entertained by, and I'm going to sleep in. And you say, Bill, can you help me Saturday morning with something? And you explain what's going on. You've got a refrigerator, a washer, dryer, and a stove in your basement. They're covered in dust. If you move enough stuff, you should be able to get them out to that skinny little staircase you have. But they pick up around 8:15 in the morning, so you really want me to get there early. Could you come by around 7 and help me out? And I look at you and I say, 7 o'clock? Sure. I'm stroking my nose, folks. If I give you an answer while stroking my nose, we see that specific behavior as the 2000 equivalent of twirling the mustache. It is 85 to 90% likelihood of a lie. Nose twitching, or because what happens when you lie is you actually have nerve endings on your nose that tickle. So we tend to touch our nose. Any nose pulling, nose tugging, we're going to associate with deception. So when you see this nose scratch and a person is speaking, it is a self-editing behavior. What they're saying is, I don't believe what I'm saying. How about this one? I look at you and I say, 7 a.m., I'll do it. I'll even head nod to confuse you. Because we're socially responsible to give the correct answer, right? I'll tell you what sounds right, but I'm not going to make it. Horizontal grasp while speaking, 65 to 70% likelihood of a lie. Third option, vertical grasp. I look at you and I say, you know what? I'll do it. But my fingers are pointed upward over my lip, statistically 50-50. Any time you speak through your own hand, and it will happen to you personally in the next 72 hours, I guarantee that your kid's going to come up to you and say, Dad, remember you said you'd go out and help me build a clubhouse? You're going to say, yeah, I remember. I guarantee you're going to self-edit. You're going to see yourself doing this and raise your awareness level to the point where you're uncomfortable. So that's what we're looking at with hand-to-face behavior. All right? How is it processed? Men tend to not see it. Women tend to see it very clearly. All right? It is one indication of deception. We're looking at trustworthiness here. If you recall yesterday, I talked about trustworthiness. I said, you've got to project it. It has to come across very quickly. How do you do it? What would be the best way to project trustworthiness? You know what the answer is? I can't tell you. It is to be comfortable with yourself. It's to be comfortable with yourself. If I were to give you behaviors to engage in, you would look contrived. I don't want to do it. So what we've learned is just being yourself. Now, you may have some unfortunate behaviors that send the wrong message. What I want to do in regards to trustworthiness is not look at behavior that will project trustworthiness, but look at behaviors to avoid. We're going to look at deception. You've heard that you can pick up whether somebody's lying by their facial features on that TV show, Lie to Me. I'm sure you can. Generally speaking, they're very, very difficult to read. There's all kinds of anomalies going on. Forget that. I'm going to give you two profiles. We have two types of deceivers or liars. Type one are incompetent liars. Type two are highly competent liars. We make a mistake when we don't distinguish between the two. So I'm going to share with you. First profile is going to be incompetent liars. And I'll tell you what, if you are engaged in a communication with an incompetent liar and you haven't figured out that they're lying to you, there is more than one incompetent in the room. These people wave flags in front of you if you know what to look for. So let's take a look at incompetent or type 1, Roman numeral 1 is how we label it, type 1 deception. Behavior number one, eye contact. Let's see what they're doing with their eyes. First, they're going to not look you in the eyes. Less than 30% eye contact. What is the average when we communicate face-to-face? 77%. And these people are under 30%. They almost invariably look downward. It's extremely rare to have a liar who looks up while lying. Why? Because they've already calculated their message. They don't have to look up. We calculate in the upper parts of our brain. They're going to look down. They don't want you to see the falsehood that they are projecting. So they disengage visually. They look down and left and right. Okay? There are about 12 to 18% of the population who are auditory learners. This is unfortunate because these people tend to look at their own ears when they're speaking. They literally, Richard Nixon is a classic example of an auditory learner. He was called Tricky Dick. Why? He had shifty eyes. Fact, he was an auditory learner. He listened. Whenever he read, he heard the words that he was reading. He was saying them out loud. And he would actually look while giving a speech, look straight to the sides at his own ears. It gave him an aura of deception. Turns out he deserved it. But he was also an auditory listener. Auditory learner. So kind of interesting. Eye contact under 30%. Downward glance is almost always a giveaway. The other thing I'm looking at is when they look you in the eye, they will flutter dramatically. We now have digital technology in HD, so we can measure all kinds of things we could only guess about before. In 4 to 6 seconds, an incompetent liar can eye flutter or flash their eyes over 180 times. That is a pretty nifty number. Have you ever seen somebody say, yeah, totally, and they're fluttering like crazy? That would be a good indication that you are experiencing deception. When you lie, you use 14 different centers of the brain. When you tell the truth, you use 6. That is a very easy activity by comparison. So almost 2.5 times more mental activity. What does that mean? That means you will invariably experience a phenomenon we call internal arousal. When a person lies, what are they doing? They are A, making a decision to lie. B, calculating percentage. How much of a lie do I want to get across with? 100%? 30%? How much masking do I want to engage in? Third, they have to calculate the words that will conform to that lying behavior. They're also going to manage consciously, if they're at least a little bit accurate in what they're trying to achieve, their own physical behavior. They know they've got to mask some of their signals. In addition, almost every liar is going to look at you to determine if you bought the lie. So we do a phenomenon, or we have a thing that we call eye checking. All right. So I'll say, hey, I really like that tie you're wearing. I'll look away and look back up to see how it registers with you. I'm concerned about whether or not you're buying or, you know, accepting my lie. So I'll almost always check your behavior. So all of the eye behavior, that's what we're looking at with an incompetent liar. You secrete adrenaline when you experience internal arousal, and that means your body's going to be engaged in the lie. All right? Let's stay with the face. I'm looking at a funny thing, because when you secrete adrenaline, you cannot secrete saliva. So you will experience cotton mouth or dry mouth. You will see people lip licking. We have a former president who licked his lips every time he lied and bit his bottom lip whenever he lied. Okay? He shall remain nameless, but he was the last Democratic president before the current one. What we found happening was there were a lot of mouth tells with this individual. So we're looking at lip biting, lip licking. When we're looking at the face, we're also monitoring vocal hesitancies, stuttering and stammering, just grasping for the right words. We are going to find that a person who lies either tells or says far too few words for the situation or substantially too many. Thou doth protest too much. And so we're looking at all of this vocal stuff going on as well. When we look at an incompetent liar, the real killer for me is they are secreting adrenaline, and with adrenaline, they will fidget. They will move around their bodies. They'll rub their hands together. When training police interrogators, we look primarily for two behaviors to determine whether or not you have deception: low level of eye contact and hand twitching and fidgeting. If they're rubbing their hands together, washing, watch people on stage. They get real nervous. They're totally healthy people. They'll nonetheless clutch a lectern. The more a person moves while speaking, and, you know, I'm describing fear, aren't I? People say to me, well, what if they're nervous? They're going to exhibit those behaviors. When you look at a person to determine whether or not they're telling the truth, gauge the behavior while they are speaking, contrast it or compare it to the behavior they exhibit when they're not speaking. If they're intimidated by you, I mean, they're going to go through all these gestures and movements, whether or not they're speaking. If, however, they're only engaged in deception, they engage in those behaviors only when their mouth is working. That's a real easy way to figure out what you're dealing with. Fidgeting, moving around. If you haven't figured it out by now, they turn red, they turn white, they perspire. The bigger the lie, the far more physiology is involved, and it should be relatively easy to detect. I have a rule of thumb. I'll tell you what it is. If I question whether or not someone's telling the truth, I almost always assume they are not. That is the other two brains processing data, trying to give me a hint something's going on. Competent liar. Let me move to this side of the stage. A competent liar is fun. These people have skill. That sucker is using a low level of eye contact. This individual knows you're looking for a low level of eye contact. He will maintain over 90% eye contact. Too much eye contact. Number one clue that someone's giving you a lie. The guy over here is stuttering and stammering. This individual, the competent liar, experiences a phenomenon we call hyperfluency. He's remarkably fluent. Have you ever worked with somebody who's so good they sound like they've practiced? Odds are they did. And so what we see is too much fluency. It's always a fear that I have with sales professionals. Don't you kind of get into a group? Tell me you haven't had this experience. You're sitting with Mr. and Mrs. Prospect. You're three-fourths of the way through your presentation, and suddenly you like kind of come back to consciousness and say, what have I been saying? I have no recollection. You know, we all get on autopilot. It happens to me on stage. I'll think I've got 10 minutes to go. I'll look, and I've spoken for 10 minutes. And I'm thinking, wow, I must be really tired because I am confusing. Did I say this? Did I say that? And I'll actually experience some fear. What happens with a competent liar is they sound contrived, because they are. So too much fluency, too much eye contact. They're still secreting adrenaline. In fact, they're secreting a lot of adrenaline because they're really monitoring their own behavior, but they only monitor certain clues. They will hold one hand in the other or conceal their hands. Subconsciously, hand concealment is a big one. So when I see somebody who's using a lot of gestures, realize gestures are ethnic. We don't know how this happens, but I'll tell you how it works. You could be fourth generation American, but if you call yourself Italian, you're still doing this when you speak. Northern Mediterranean region, they gesture out on the sides of their heads. Greeks, Italians, this is a normal gesture sequence, okay? French, Eastern European, they gesture in front of their own sternum. Jewish, same gesture pattern, gesturing in front of their own heart, okay? Scandinavians, this would be it, folks. A mad gesture sequence indicating a fire in the room. They literally do not gesture. The best you get from them is, Inga, the hot tub is this way, and off they go. It's incredible. You could be here for 150 years, and for some reason, the gestures are what we're starting to find is that they are, in fact, genetically created. And if you're Italian, if you're Greek, you're out here, if you're other, we just follow those patterns. It's fascinating to me to see how that works, but that's how it works. What we see with a competent liar is that gestures drop at least 75%. They're too busy lying and engaging in monitoring of behavior. So when they gestured effusively and all of a sudden there's no gesturing, I get the alert. If they conceal their hands below the table or behind their backs, you know that that is something that is, should be seen as a cue. But look for a cluster of cues. You don't want just one thing. You want a handful. I'd rather have seven or eight things telling me the same message than one behavior, because people do odd things. They don't necessarily project nonverbal competence. A competent liar will talk too much. The big thing I look for with competence in deception is they break down the emotional barriers displayed by physical behavior that we have to protect ourselves. They come over and give you an effusive handshake or a hug when you've never met them. When somebody breaks that barrier, I'm automatically concerned. Okay, so I'm always alert for too much touch. We're going to find that people who are competent liars process almost everything except space management. They get far too close to you, or they'll be very comfortable sitting far away. We transact business at a distance of 4 to 6 feet in this country. If you have somebody 8 feet away and they're very comfortable talking to you, I'm going to ask, what's the deal? Is he incompetent, or is something going on that I need to monitor? I look at foot behavior. When we work with police departments, we're going to find two things happening. We're going to find that competent liars have adrenaline, and adrenaline causes you to exhibit some kind of body motion. Foot grinding is a remarkably accurate tool for measuring deception. If I've got a person who is sitting up and really confident in what they're saying, and yet the toe is pointed into the floor and they're grinding their foot as they speak, I'm extremely concerned about deception. Foot grinding, and especially when they stop speaking, if the foot drops, I'm almost guaranteed that some additional agenda is being played here, and it's likely to be deception. 94% accurate, I'll share it with you. We are going to find an extremely rare behavior that is incredibly accurate as a tell if somebody's lying. If you've noticed, I've turned my entire lower body away from you. If you are speaking to a person, and we found this in two situations, one was in police interrogation studies, one was in boardrooms, ironically, in corporate America, that if a person should turn their lower body towards an open window or door while speaking, the odds are 94% accurate. They are engaging in deception. Boardroom, I'm working with a woman's shelter. I am a board member for a woman's shelter for abused women and children. My director is constantly turning her lower body towards the door when she speaks to the board. Going back about 6 years now, what am I supposed to do? I'm the vice president of the board of trustees. Should I go to the president and say, did you see her lower body? I think she's lying to us. Well, I'm going to look like an idiot. I raised my awareness level. I tried to find out what was wrong, and I had no idea. But the behavior continued for 2 years. I stepped down because of my travel schedule. I wasn't able to meet responsibilities necessary to stay on that board. And it wasn't until about 6 or 7 months later, I was going to sleep in San Francisco, and I got a phone call from my wife. She said, guess who made the evening news? Susan. I said, Susan who? And she told me. She said she's been embezzling for almost 6 years. They have the dollar amount somewhere between $200,000 and $250,000. I'm not a forensic accountant. I couldn't figure it out. She would take a cash advance whenever she went to Harrisburg, and she'd go 2 or 3 times a month to meet with politicians or do whatever it is she had to do. She would then charge everything during the trip and pay her visa bill after the fact. Nobody caught on for years. The behavior was accurate. I just couldn't put a handle on it. And you'll see that happening when you raise your awareness level regarding that. That is trustworthiness in a nutshell. And I apologize for spending so much time on it. Let's do what you women have been waiting to hear. Personal power. Let's go there. But before we do, let's have a little exercise, all right? We're going to find that men and women communicate differently. In my field of study, we have identified over 38,000 behaviors that have specific meanings. 38,000 behaviors. Of 38,000 behaviors that we've labeled and identified, there are but three, that men project regularly with far greater accuracy than women. One is pretty significant. It is the ability in a business setting to project personal power. Gentlemen, the behavior associated with power historically is male behavior because we historically had positions of power. How often do you women get away with this behavior? Classic power behavior, right? You know it so well if you're in a large organization and you're sitting in this position, your boss enters your office, you do what three things to save face? You drop your feet, you sit up straight, you look embarrassed. All right, that's the proper response, and every guy here knows it. However, if you go into Mr. Big's office and catch him in this position, you will be speaking to Mr. Foot. And guess what? How is that behavior projecting personal power? Let me analyze it from our academic perspective. By exposing the stomach, the one part of the mammal not protected by a skeletal structure, I am showing vulnerability. How is it, and we find it to be 100% accurate, when a male puts his foot up on furniture, he's projecting personal power? That young Turk who puts a foot up on the boardroom table, you ever have anybody do that in your office? Put a foot up on the edge of your desk, they are telling you, I have personal power, Mac. Showing the soles of your feet projects personal power. How so? The greatest number of nerve endings in your body are located in the soles of your feet. You are caught stealing in China. What is your punishment? Caning. They beat the soles of your feet with a wooden cane. They do not have a theft problem in China because whoever gets caned doesn't do it again. Okay? That's a remarkable penalty. Why the soles of your feet? Greatest number of nerve endings. So I mean, people say to me, so what is all this about? What's that got to do with personal power? I'm going to quote my 15-year-old on this one. When I've got my feet up on the desk and my hands behind the head and you walk into my office and I maintain that position, what exactly am I saying? I am saying the following, and I'll quote my 15-year-old. Sometimes they do say it more accurately than we do. You are so not a threat that I don't have to cover up. That's what's being said. All right? Gentlemen, women do everything we do to project personal power, but with flair. You remember nothing else from this conference? You take this one to the bank. Back row, stand up. We're watching my feet here. Females are trained to sit in one of three positions, right, ladies? Why are women better at body language? Because at age 4 and 5, you were being trained. Do you remember the training? Not one man in this room ever had the following experience as a 5-year-old. Put those knees together, big fella. But every one of you women was taught there's a way to sit, and you're not showing it at this time. Women are trained to sit in a 4-point, which is 2 knees, 2 ankles together. All right? A 2-point cross, which is 1 knee atop the other. Or in a behavior I cannot exhibit because I'm not a female. But what they do is they take that one leg, wrap it around the other leg 4 times, and throw it off to the side. All right? The odds are substantially great that your wife or any female with whom you are engaging is sitting in a 2-point cross. This is the behavior I want every guy in this room to see. Your wife has done this to you for decades. Today, you go home enriched. Don't ever fall for this one again. When she is disagreeing with you, and it's going to be a female, it could be a family member, mother-in-law, it could be a social event with a woman you don't even know, it could be a prospect or client. When you are speaking and she is rejecting your message, she will not do this. She has too much dignity to move in that direction. She will simply give you the foot. If that bad boy goes up for 4 seconds, you just got rejected, Mac. Right? Exclusively a female behavior. That foot goes up and holds. There is not a male. I've done this for 27 years now. I have never seen a male with his legs crossed engaged in that behavior. Not once. And if you are the male who does it, now would probably not be the time to step forward. We are lonely enough to have done this. We have researched women. I know the first thing I thought was it's got to do with high heels. It turns out, no. Women who wear exclusively flats engage in the same behavior, and we create situations. I researched the behavior. I had 40 women who are sole proprietors, business owners, come into my office. We said, you're a successful female professional. We want your business biography. We want to know how you did it. Well, you don't think they were lining up to talk to us? They were dying to get in there and talk to us. We had a very charismatic and attractive graduate, male graduate student sitting there, and he took notes. When he sat down to get her biography, he looked her in the eye. He head nodded. He said, "You're kidding. That's amazing." He wrote feverishly. He was totally engaged. About 8 minutes into the discussion, we turn a light on behind her head. A little red light in the wall. She didn't see it, but he did. His behavior now moves to poor listening behavior. So instead of engaging in the conversation and really showing involvement, he looked at his watch. We had an open door behind him. We had people start walking through the hallway. So he'd say, "Well, tell me how you manage that one." He'd be looking at, and then he'd look at whoever was walking by. Guess what, folks? Within 1 minute, 60 seconds, 32 out of 40 women gave him the foot. 80% of our female participants unwittingly verified the research that we were engaged in. They signaled disapproval by showing the soles of their feet. That woman is asserting personal power and saying, "I disagree with you," or "I disagree with the behavior in which you're engaged." And that's how we determine that behavior. Kind of an interesting study. All right? Women do project personal power. It's very, very, very difficult to measure because we don't get the same behaviors from women. But I'm going to get into personal power in a moment. I said there were 38,000 behaviors we were engaged in, and that only 3 men project with greater accuracy than women. One is projecting personal power in a business setting. We have the behavior that does it. Now, women project personal power in interpersonal relations. Right, ladies? You'll do it one-on-one when you're speaking with us. I don't want to take anything from you because I think you're very artful. And I'm looking at the males in the room, and I'll make you this guarantee, ladies. When you're exhibiting personal power in one-on-one communication, these goobers don't even know there's a power game going on. Do you want to hear the other 2 behaviors, guys? What do you think? Go for it? Okay. USC definitively proves that men have an intellectual state that they display with far greater accuracy than women. Now that's great news, wouldn't you think? We project an intellectual state with far greater accuracy than women. Let me tell you precisely what it is. Men apparently project stupidity with far greater accuracy than women. All right? What does it look like? Well, I'll make you this guarantee. If you didn't crack a smile when I said that, you may be displaying it at this moment. Mouth gaping open and doing the 1,000-yard stare, you have arrived. Number three, you're going to tell me. I'll give you the scenario, and I want your answers. I want you to yell. Let's get a little energy going here. What do you say? USC and UCLA do a joint study. They take 30 men and 30 women. They take still photographs of each of these people projecting the 10 most common emotions, joy, sadness, disgust, surprise, and all the rest. They will do 12,000 observations in 4 different parts of the country. They want to know, of the 10 most common emotions, is there in fact at least one that men project with far greater accuracy than women? And it turns out, yes, there is in fact one behavior, one emotion that men project with far greater accuracy than women. Think about it. What do you think it is? Now I'm going to ask for your answer. Yell it out. What is the one emotion that men project with far greater accuracy than women? Condescension. I love it, Roy. You made my day, baby. I don't know. It's not one of the 10 most common. I'll tell you what, though. They're good. They're very good. Most of you said what? Anger. All right? And if it was a male saying anger, I will guarantee you're married. I guarantee it. It turns out, no. No! It is not anger. We have some ex-wife photos we'd like you to view. You know, it would be easy to say men project anger with far greater accuracy than women, but we're going to take a little deeper look here. It is not anger, but that is almost always the number one answer that I get. Now, why isn't it anger? I'll tell you how it works, because men and women express anger differently. For a man, anger is a high intensity, but a low duration event. Now, for a woman, anger is a medium to high intensity event that will, in fact, last forever. All right? They project it differently than we do. It is not anger. Since it's not anger, and I love condescension, but that's not it, what do you think it is? Apathy, that's lack of emotion. We're looking at I think we're good at apathy. I can't disagree. In fact, I think we're very good, but it's not technically emotion. I'm looking at emotions. 10 most common emotions. What is the one, the only one that men project with far greater accuracy than women? Lust. Well, let's go there. I will never walk away from that one. We have done the research. In fact, it's fun research to read about. And what we've determined is that men and women and crazed weasels project lust about evenly. I'm stunned that nobody has guessed it. I'm going to give you a clue. How many of you men are married? Almost all of you. That's your clue. What is the one emotion that men project with greater accuracy than women? You're killing me. Yeah. Yeah, that was it. Oh, God. Right up my nose. I didn't see that one coming. It's guilt. Men project guilt with far greater accuracy than women. Are you serious? You're killing me up here. I'll tell you what, we looked at anger a little more deeply. We're going to look at guilt. Men and women experience guilt differently. Here's what we know. This I find fascinating. Married men project guilt almost 3 times more accurately than single men, which would suggest what? Practice, practice, practice. Guilt for a male is a 2-person event. See if you guys don't agree with this one. I'm going to phrase it in a manner that it makes sense for you. You guys have done stuff you thought was funny until you got found out. I'm no different. Ladies, correct me if I'm wrong. If you experience guilt, our research is pretty clear on this, you'll almost certainly do it to yourselves. you actually have a conscience. So what happens is that guilt is an internal mental event. All right? Women are not used to projecting it facially. They experience it as an internal mental event. Let me prove it to you. In fact, prove it to yourself. Go home, look your spouse in the face, gentlemen, and say, honey, can you project guilt through facial expression? She'll say, of course. It's an emotion. Say, oh, do it now. I'll save you a step, because here's what you're going to say. She'll say, okay, give me a second. Guilt. It's coming to me. No, really. They can't do it. Again, we've done the research. It turns out in our culture that women are so busy creating it that they're not getting the practice time. You know what I'm saying? All right, let's take a look at personal power. Personal power. Let's have a little fun. I want you in the back row to stand up. I am going to show you what happens. We're going to look at this in a little bit of depth. When I signal stand, because you want to see this, we're going to look at four behaviors, male profile. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to act them out on stage. I will show you the appropriate behavior for projecting personal power. And then, so it sinks into your subconscious, I will polarize. I will show you the exact opposite behavior. This will really sink it home. Are you ready? First behavior for males, and I'm doing it sitting down, we are looking at relaxed muscle tone. I walk into a Rotary Club luncheon, a Kiwanis Club luncheon, and I realize, oh my, I only have three business cards. Who do I give them to? I'm going to go to the person who exhibits these four behaviors. Behavior number one, and I'm going to tell you right now, high personal power correlates with high net worth and high social status. More with high net worth than status, but generally speaking, if a person has $1 million in investable assets, you'll be able to pick them out with almost 80% accuracy using this simple tool. Behavior number one, relaxed muscle tone. Generally speaking, relaxed muscle tone is the most accurate cue. They are projecting the absence of fear. So you tell me, more personal power and net worth in this position? Or would you go with this one? Comic, isn't it? My toes are turned inward here. Absolutely incorrect. Almost all, and it's 98% of high net worth individuals have their toes turned outward. Male profiles, so not for you ladies. All right? We're also going to find that if you looked, I had raised eyebrows that were suspended and stayed in that position. That is the primate indication of surrender. All right? I have a mouth, and I get on stage, and I say stuff I probably shouldn't say. I'm in San Diego. And I went to the zoo, and there were 8 gorillas in the gorilla cage, or gorilla park, whatever they call it. And 7 of them are like this. I'm sorry, 7 have their eyebrows raised dramatically, and 1 has his eyebrows down. And I'll make you a guarantee, only one of these guys is mating. All right? That is dominance, downward glance, or downward with the forehead. If you see suspended forehead up, or we call it furrowed, that's what you're seeing. What we're looking at here is relaxed muscle tone. So I'm going to go with this over any other behavior. Number two we're looking at is emotional disengagement. Now, women, you're good at body language. You're real good. But there's a flaw. I want to tell you what it is. 2 of them, actually. It is this, that women tend to focus on a thing called facial expression. Facial expression is good, but it's not what we think. When we research facial expression, we will find that the longest facial expression on record lasts 3 to 5 seconds. That's all. The average facial expression is about 1.5 to 2 seconds in length. And the longest one is shock, which is 3 to 5 seconds. You'll actually see people doing this to your face when you're experiencing shock. So when you're looking at facial expression, you better be really focused when the expression occurs or you're going to miss it. What we're finding is that if you're looking at a male to determine facial expression and what emotional state he's exhibiting, you've got yourself a bit of a dilemma. Males typically do not project emotion through the face or any other means. So we're looking at an emotional state.